Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The protests turned deadly in Egypt today as supporters of President Hosni Mubarak clashed with anti-government demonstrators. Authorities there report at least three people are dead. And the volatile climate is only being fueled by worries over where the money will come from. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. And by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at microsoft.com/cloud.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Appreciate having you with us this Wednesday. It's the 2nd of February and the fourth straight day that banks in Egypt have been shut. ATMs there have been running dry. And then there's this financial obstacle. Family and friends outside Egypt, a significant source of capital for the economy there, have no way to send money back home. Here's Marketplace's Alisa Roth.
Mohammed El Hariri just wants to be a good son. He's a Western Union agent in a Middle Eastern neighborhood in New York. And like a lot of his customers, he sends money to his family in Egypt. But for the last couple of days, he hasn't been able to.
Now, there's no way to send. The bank's closed, the Western Union's closed. No communication between the United States and Egypt.
That's because in Egypt, money transmitters like Western Union work through local banks, and those are shut down for the moment. The World Bank estimates that last year Egyptians sent about $7.7 billion home. That's only about 4% of Egypt's GDP, but remittances rank as one of the country's biggest sources of foreign capital, much bigger, for example, than U.S. aid to Egypt. And that money from abroad is obviously important to the individual families lucky enough to get it. Raghi Assad is a professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Affairs. He estimates that remittances account for a quarter of the household income for families that receive the money. He says right now, though, Egypt's money troubles extend far beyond remittances.
The serious problem right now for people is that they have money in the bank and they're not able to access it to get cash. And that, whether they receive remittances or not, everybody is having the same problem.
El Hariri, the Western Union worker, says his mother is doing okay without his cash.
You know, maybe she gets from a friend or something until I will be able to send back the money.
The banks will reportedly reopen Sunday. The bigger concern then may be that wealthier Egyptians want to send their money out of the country. I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
Good news. We won't be $14 trillion-plus in debt quite as fast as we thought. The Treasury Department figures we might not hit the official debt ceiling till May. If lawmakers don't raise the limit, a lot of people, from Medicare patients to government workers, could be left holding the bag. But some in Congress think there's a way to stop borrowing without necessarily defaulting. Our D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
If Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling, it has to stop borrowing and spend less. That means it could miss interest payments to its debt holders, investors in government bonds. A default would shake the financial credibility of the United States. But at a hearing this week, new Republican Senator Patrick Toomey asked a group of economists, why not put Treasury bond holders at the head of the line?
Is it possible that the Treasury could nevertheless ensure that those people holding the marketable securities of this government would receive their interest payments?
But giving priority to debt holders would force some difficult choices, according to economist David Malpass at Insima Global.
So what would happen each week is someone, meaning the Treasury Department or you, members of Congress, would have to be deciding who not to pay.
Border guards, bank regulators, air traffic controllers. Tea Party activists say sticking to the current ceiling and paying debt holders first is a way to force tough spending cuts without shaking investor confidence. But MIT management professor Simon Johnson warned even a hint that Congress would let the government bump up against its borrowing limit will frighten foreign debt holders.
Senator, I think you're playing with fire. I really don't think that you want to create potential disruptions of this kind, because there's nothing that says that the dollar has to be the number one reserve asset forever.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has said breaching the debt limit could cause more harm to the economy than the financial crisis did 2 years ago. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
I found something good to say about the winter storm blanketing most of the nation. It kept the groundhog from seeing his shadow today, which supposedly means an early spring. And it can't come soon enough for the airline industry, which looks to be headed for a record month of cancellations. The snow also brought a halt to work at 22 Ford, GM, and Chrysler plants, and meat and grain deliveries have been curtailed. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange stayed open, though its trading floor was cluttered with overnight bags. Which brings us to the financial hedging that's possible and even the money-making potential in something called snow derivatives. Here's our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore.
In 2009, the CME first allowed investors to predict snowfall and make money on the exchange if they were right. We've had record snowfall ever since. CME's Tim Andreessen says companies need weather derivatives to hedge against losses when rain, heat, or snow can hurt their businesses.
Everybody says you can't manage the weather, which is true, but you can manage the financial consequences of the weather.
Andreessen sees sunny skies ahead, financially. Investors have bought five times as many snow contracts as they did last year. Jeff Hodgson of the Chicago Weather Brokerage sells snowfall derivatives. Here's how they work.
I'm going to pay $10,000. And if it snows over 40 inches in Chicago, that option will be worth $25,000. If it doesn't snow over that level, then I lose my $10,000.
Snow removers and insurance companies have the most to protect, so they're his best customers. Of course, snow derivatives only cover the cost. Someone still has to shovel it all away. I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Never mind the storm. Wall Street operated normally, if not cautiously. Details when we do the numbers. On paper, the corporate tax rate in this country is one of the highest anywhere, 35%. It's long prompted calls for reform, and the president got on that bandwagon in his State of the Union speech. But as New York Times columnist David Leonhardt points out in the paper today, there's a paradox. The taxes that some big corporations pay really aren't so high. In fact, they're quite small, considering. Hello, David.
Hi.
So, you report that Boeing paid a total tax rate of just 4.5% over 5 years, Southwest Airlines a little over 6%, Yahoo 7%, and even Mammoth General Electric just a little more than 14%. Any idea how it is that particular companies seem better at avoiding taxes than others?
Some companies just hire really good lawyers and tax experts. General Electric is famous for that. They're known as having one of the best tax departments in the world, and they'll look for any advantage to get out of paying taxes, whether it's putting some income overseas, whether it's taking advantage of loopholes that you and I have never heard of. Then beyond that, there are a couple of common reasons. The most defensible, I think, is that some companies lost large amounts of money in prior years. Yahoo fits that description. So does Amazon. And so they're still deducting those losses. Another one, which I think is less defensible, is that if you invest a lot of money in expanding, you get to reduce your taxes.
That's kind of the goal of businesses, though, right?
Well, expanding is the goal of businesses, but from the standpoint of the economy, we want our resources used in the most efficient way. And if an airline has an incentive to do more expansion, or a drug company has an incentive to do more research because of the tax code, they're going to do more than ends up being efficient for the economy as a whole. And we're going to end up having drug companies doing lots of research that, in fact, doesn't pay off, which in fact we've had. We're going to have too many planes bought. And that will be because once you take into account the tax break, it can be profitable to do something that otherwise would not be profitable.
Your analysis comes as the government goes deeper and deeper in debt. I came away from reading your column with the idea that the corporate income tax is an untapped source of revenue, and you write that it has been in the past?
It is something of an untapped source of revenue. Now, the problem, of course, is that businesses want to see their taxes cut. So from a lobbying standpoint, from a political standpoint, it's going to be quite difficult to raise corporate taxes. But from an economic standpoint, given the kind of deficits we're facing over the long term, mostly because of Medicare, I think there's a very strong case for reducing the rate, but also eliminating even more deductions. So the net effect would be a fall in the rate, but still a net increase in corporate taxes.
On the other hand, we have free market forces consistently arguing that taxing corporations stymies business growth and can actually lead to bringing in less revenue.
That's possible, but it's worth remembering that while we could get taxes to a point where they would really damage economic activity, the argument that higher tax rates, no matter what, lead to worse economic growth is an argument that looks very bad today. That's what we heard in the 90s when Congress and President Bill Clinton raised taxes. After that, we had an economic boom. We heard the reverse over the past decade. The tax cuts of 2001 and 2003 would lead to a great economic surge. And instead, we had the slowest growth of any decade since World War II. So tax rates matter, but they don't matter nearly as much as people often suggest.
You end your column with this observation: any system that creates as many winners as this one won't be changed easily. Let me see if I can take you beyond that. Do you see any scenarios where this might be changed, particularly given the current makeup of Congress?
I think it's very unlikely, but sure, you could come up with a scenario. I mean, the story of the 1986 tax reform signed by President Reagan, which is really a very good bill, the same thing you could have said back then, which is, how is this ever going to happen? It requires overcoming a huge number of special interests. So there are times in the political moment in which you can have changes that hurts special interests and is for the larger good. But they're relatively rare, and this doesn't seem likely to be a moment when we're going to see that.
You can read David Leonhardt's column in today's New York Times. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thank you, Bob.
As we told you at the top of the program, demonstrations in Egypt turned violent today following President Hosni Mubarak's vow to serve out his current term. Both the U.S. and European Union are calling on Egypt's government to begin its transition now and end attacks on protesters. The events unfolding in Egypt over the last few days have commentator David Frum thinking about the role of economics in political unrest.
Much of the press coverage of Egypt has emphasized President Mubarak's lack of democratic legitimacy, which is true enough, of course. Also true that this lack is not unique. Yet undemocratic China has a generally quiescent public. In fact, if opinion surveys can be trusted, China's people express more satisfaction with national conditions than those of any other large society on Earth. Why? How do you say, "It's the economy, stupid," in Mandarin? Let's compare Egypt and China. When Hosni Mubarak assumed power in 1981, Egypt's per capita GDP was 250% greater than China's. Today, China's is 50% greater than Egypt's. Since 1981, the Egyptian economy has grown, and grown faster than its population. That's impressive, because Egypt's population has doubled since 1981, from 40 million to 80 million. But Egypt's economy has grown nowhere fast enough to satisfy the aspirations of its people. Half the country subsists on less than $2 a day. Upward mobility is blocked. Egypt has the largest population of unemployed college graduates in the Middle East. China's rapid economic growth and slow population growth has raised incomes so fast that ordinary Chinese people see meaningful improvements in their lives. Better food, better housing, better clothing. Yes, many Chinese obviously remain very poor, but enough Chinese have benefited rapidly enough that they understandably prefer to wait for further betterment rather than do anything that might upset an improving status quo. China's turn toward dynamic capitalism has bestowed legitimacy on its otherwise authoritarian government. Egypt's sluggish state-controlled economy has fomented the discontent, now shaking the state's controllers. There is a lesson embedded there for dictators, and for democratic leaders, too.
David Frum is the editor of Frum Forum and a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Robert Reich is up in the rotation next week. Your views? Anytime at marketplace.org. Coming up, is one country's mood starting to affect their money?
Public optimism is not a very common tradition in Bulgaria. We don't want to mess with good luck, so we say things are bad.
But first, let's do the numbers. Even though fresh data showed private employers added more jobs than expected in January, investors held back. The Dow and the S&P 500 closed at their highest point since 2008 yesterday. They sputtered today. The Dow Industrials put on a point, no real change, to close at 12,041. The Nasdaq lost 1 point, also virtually flat, to finish at 2,749. The S&P 500 fell 3 points, or 0.25%, to end at 1,304. Arctic Cat scratched off more than 1%. The maker of snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles, plus accessories and clothing, tripled its net quarterly income, but that didn't warm investors. Whirlpool drained more than 2%. The appliance maker missed profit estimates. The 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 3.48%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses and nonprofits make sense of social media. You can learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Reputation.com, protecting and improving your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its preliminary productivity and costs report for the fourth quarter. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke discusses the economic recovery at the National Press Club. And the Senate Budget Committee examines challenges for the U.S. economic recovery. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. When the nearest competitor has a mere 12% of the search market, it might not seem Google has much to worry about, but that's not stopping the online juggernaut from screaming foul. Google claims it has proof that Microsoft's search engine Bing has been spying on Google searches and stealing the results. Bing's response? What are you going to do about it? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
Last year, Google started noticing rival search engine Bing was delivering some eerily similar search results. Google fellow Amit Singhal.
We started this scientific experiment to confirm our suspicion.
That's right. Google launched a sting operation. Google planted dummy searches, linking nonsense words to unrelated sites. For instance, if you Googled the word Indoswift job in production, you'd be taken to the Food Network's website. Sure enough, a few weeks later, if you typed that nonsense word into Bing, Food Network. Again, Google's Amit Singhal.
Now, this just confirmed completely that Bing is taking results from Google's search algorithm and presenting it to their users.
Google accused Microsoft of using its Internet Explorer web browser to spy on users' Google searches, and then using that information to beef up Bing. Danny Sullivan with Search Engine Land broke the story. He says suing Bing would be hard, so Google was hoping to shame Bing into stopping.
That's certainly not been the reaction. They've kind of shrugged it off as no big deal.
Microsoft told Marketplace it doesn't copy Google and that it uses multiple approaches in its search results. Online security expert Barrett Lyon says he doesn't think consumers will care, and industry insiders are kind of impressed.
Well, I talked with my development team about this morning, and they all thought that Microsoft was being very creative and innovative.
Bing has seen its searches grow, but Google still has more than two-thirds of the market. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday. Time to check the inbox.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Thomas DiCarlo from Bloomington, Indiana, wrote to us about our story on turning trash into electricity. He thought the environmental friendliness of the idea was garbage.
Hearing the business reps say that their modern facility is non-toxic is like the coal industry making up the idea of clean coal. If it is possible to incinerate garbage without creating dioxins, a very dangerous byproduct of burning plastic, and simultaneously eliminate all the toxins we throw away, then that should be the story here.
We focused early this week on the Egyptian government blocking web access. Fred Kinch of Westfield, New Jersey, wrote to complain that the press assumed social media played a bigger role than it did and that we fell into the same trap.
As if BlackBerries and iPhones were the only thing capable of catalyzing a revolution. They seem to forget that the Bolshevik Revolution, the overthrow of the Shah of Iran, and even the Boston Tea Party were all fueled by a more traditional form of social media, word of mouth.
Charles Sandmel of Brookline, Massachusetts, heard our story on the panic lurking in the municipal bond market. He wanted to clear something up. Municipal defaults are very rare.
No major local government has filed for bankruptcy since Orange County in 1994, and no bonds defaulted in that event. No state has defaulted since Arkansas in the 1930s, and the state cured the default the next year.
Finally, Mark Duggan of Palm City, Florida, heard our story on some environmental drawbacks to telecommuting, so he came up with a few reasons for not driving to the office.
Wear and tear on the car, tires, brakes, oil changes all require energy to replenish. Dress clothing, anything made of polyester or blend that is petroleum-based. Also, dry cleaning for work clothes, the chemicals are all derived from petroleum and hazardous to the environment.
No need to travel far to leave us a comment. Just click on the contact link at marketplace.org, and you'll find links there to follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Can the financial system be redesigned to better serve more people? That's the stuff of our Marketplace series, Economy 4.0. Instead of just following the money, perhaps we should take a better account of our happiness and well-being. Influential financial leaders talked about that at the Davos conference that just wrapped in Switzerland. But researchers have yet to resolve a key question. To what extent do happiness and money go hand in hand? Our special correspondent David Brancaccio traveled to, of all places, Bulgaria to find out.
Sunlight peaks into a winter's day in Sofia, the capital of Bulgaria. A mom sits on a concrete bench, her little boy quietly playing with a friend. Happy? I think it's getting worse and worse, she says. She reads water meters for the city utility and sees a lot of apartments. I know how people live, she says. Most barely make ends meet. Surveys confirm that Bulgarians are relatively miserable, which is a little weird, given how well the Bulgarian economy has been growing. Georgi Angelov is a senior economist with the Open Society Institute in Sofia.
We had about 13 years of increasing economic growth, which is maybe unprecedented in our history.
The other good news is that export growth is the highest in the European Union.
Bulgaria is a reasonably developed country, so you would expect it to be very happy. But Bulgaria is sad relative to its income.
Justin Wolfers and a colleague at the Wharton Business School discovered that while richer individuals are not necessarily happier, the richer the country as a whole, the happier the country as a whole. Except Bulgaria, a somber example of why happiness is complex.
The gap between what we might expect and where they are is quite large, but they've certainly seen a lot in their lives.
They have, including a period of turbulence once communism collapsed after 1989. It shook people up. The birth rate declined, and many left. Ivo and Nadine Domozetov are a young couple who stuck it out. They own a small, nicely furnished apartment in Sofia. Ivo designs jewelry and watches Alexander, their two-year-old Lego expert. Nadine has a good job with a multinational that tests new medicines. She says her salary's fine, but her finances are often stretched by family obligations.
For example, my mother, my sister, I need to help them.
You have to share some of your income with your mother. She doesn't work or does she work?
She works, but she receives less than 300 lev.
300 lev a month. We do the math on the back of a napkin. Nadine's mother works as a librarian at the Sofia Library for about $2,400 a year. Not a month, per year, Nadine's husband confirms.
Yeah, it's cheaper here than in most of Europe, but this money is totally not enough. And she isn't the exception. That's the middle class.
And that middle class is shrinking, according to Andrei Rychev, who co-founded the Gallup International Research Company here. He draws a graph of Bulgaria under communism. Tiny elite, lots in the middle, small percentage of poor. Now there's a much bigger elite, but also a lot of people with lower incomes. In other words, increased inequality.
This have to be a source of very serious source of pessimism, of dark and or black picture of the world.
Another source of dissatisfaction may be the human tendency to keep up with the neighbors, such as those in richer parts of the European Union. Economist Georgi Ganev illustrates this by pointing out that under communism, many Bulgarians were comparing their vehicles to the old Eastern Bloc Lada.
Guess what? Almost any car looks very nice, even though it was complete crap. Now we compare with the latest Mercedes and Beamers, and you cannot be very happy.
Ganev, who works at the Center for Liberal Strategies in Sofia, says this also applies to standards of living.
Everybody in Bulgaria, when they quote why they're dissatisfied, would basically mention how things are done in Germany and Switzerland and never mention how things are done in Bosnia or Russia.
But Justin Wolfers at Wharton isn't buying that hypothesis.
The view that what matters is keeping up with the Joneses is not a view that's supported by the data. It's very intuitively plausible. It's just wrong.
Perhaps the problem is the data. According to Ganev, people can be wary about sounding too happy when pollsters ask.
Public optimism is not a very common tradition in Bulgaria. We don't want to mess with good luck, so you say things are bad.
It's a phenomenon governments need to take into account as more countries, like Britain and Canada, work to measure happiness on a regular, official basis. In Sofia, Bulgaria, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
And for another view of happiness in Bulgaria, check out David's Economy 4.0 blog at marketplace.org. And we'll have more of David's Economy 4.0 reporting on tomorrow's Marketplace Morning Report.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note, Virgin Atlantic says it always aims to go the extra mile when it comes to serving its passengers, but its customer relations department says the requests can sometimes be challenging. Some strange expectations turned up in a survey of the carrier's flight attendants. Seems some passengers have asked for the engines to be turned down to lower the noise. One passenger asked to be directed to the showers. And some just don't seem to understand why they can't open the window. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow put on a point, less than a fraction of a percent. The Nasdaq lost 1 point, less than a tenth of a percent. The S&P 500 fell 3 points, or 0.25%. Vahan Baladuni, Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this program, forget the rabbit. This is the year of the worker.
This year is different simply because migrant workers have got much more options.
Why those options could spell trouble for big business in China. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.